What does it mean to tax the uber rich? It's a conversation happening not just in Springfield, but in Washington. Also, hundreds of children in the Illinois foster system are being placed in homes where a language is spoken that isn't their native one. We hear from ProPublica Illinois about that. Plus, starting next week, the penalties for texting while driving get worse. Put down those phones. And the U.S. women's team is on a mission to win a fourth World Cup.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, how a child in a foster care system was raised with a language his biological parents don't speak. Plus, we want to talk to you about texting and driving, especially because state police are planning harsher penalties for distracted driving. That starts next week. But first, when Republicans held both chambers of Congress, they made big changes to our federal tax code. Some of those changes included tax cuts for higher income earners, corporations, some of the richest Americans. Democrats, on the other hand, have been calling for more taxes on the wealthy. Next fall, Illinois voters will decide whether or not to change our state's flat tax system. And nationally, members of Congress and presidential candidates have been floating different ideas about how to increase taxes on the very rich. I imagine we're going to hear some of this evening. Evening in the Democratic debates. It was also the subject of a conference that was held yesterday in Washington by the Economic Policy Institute. One of its keynote speakers was Democratic Representative Jan Schakowsky from Illinois' 9th Congressional District. I had a chance to speak with her on Monday afternoon, and I started by asking her about the top 1% of income earners.
The ultra wealthy have been the beneficiaries of really the best tax policies that they could write. And so what we're saying now is that the United States of America, which now has the greatest income inequality of, I believe, any industrialized nation right now, shame on us. We saw that during the shutdown when government employees ended up, after just having missing one paycheck, they're in line for food. And, you know, most people would think that a government job is a pretty good job. And so the disparity is great and growing. And so we need to tax that money. And one of the most salient provisions of the legislation that I had is a wealth tax. Capital gains right now are you pay only when you sell the stock. What we're saying is if there has been a big increase on a yearly basis, you have actually gotten dividends, you borrowed money against the money that you've gotten, that you're going to start paying at a 40% rate if you see an increase in capital gains over $500,000. That is a wealth tax. We also say that we want to, at $10 million, increase the income tax to 59%. And historically, you know, we've seen taxes in this country at a rate of 70% and even more. And the wealthy who may squeal about this are really ending up taking money out of the pockets of ordinary Americans who are bearing the burden of paying for government at rates that they simply can't afford, and deprive them of a decent retirement in life. This is the richest country in the world at the richest moment in history, and yet we have 1 out of 5 children that lives in poverty in this country. There is no excuse for this. And so I think there is growing consensus that we need to even out the tax codes that have been explicitly written for the rich and more exclusively written for the very, very rich.
And when we think about that tax code, though, when we're thinking about this, it's basically like the 0.1% or the 0.01% of this ultra wealthy. Do you think that that is factored into the tax bracket as it exists right now?
Yes, because right now The top tax bracket starts at an income of $624,000. That's it, the top tax.
And we're talking about, and so when we're talking about the 0.1%, the 0.01%, that's what, at least three times that?
Well, we're talking for the top tax rate of 59% starts at $10 million. And of course, there are people who make a billion or see an increase in $1 billion a year. So even what we're suggesting, I think, is pretty darn modest. But you're absolutely right that we have people that make, you know, I would say really obscene amounts of money in a democracy where, you know, we treasure equality. And we've seen it. We have seen all boats rise after World War II, where there was much more equality. And as the wealthy did better, so did the middle class.
So, Representative, I wonder what you would say, Representative Schakowsky, to people who might bristle at you saying that the more money people make, the more they should tax, because they might say, well, isn't a fundamental part of coming to this country that you can make as much money as you want and you shouldn't have to pay more than your fair share?
Look, nobody is going to have to change their lifestyle when we charge them the kinds of tax rates that we're talking about. But Americans have had to change their lifestyle because income has been stagnant for like three decades. And when the president proudly talks about the low unemployment rate, he isn't taking into consideration people that are working two and three jobs and still are having a hard time making ends meet. And again, I say the richest country in the world at the richest moment in history. We are seeing a hollowing out of the middle class. It has to do in part with the tax cuts. We saw a $22 trillion hole blown into the budget of the United States, creating a more deficit because the wealthiest have gotten these kinds of tax breaks. You know, and you talk about raising the minimum wage, and oh, they start crying about how much this is going to cost. The minimum wage at the United States of America at the federal level is $7.25 an hour, condemning workers who will work full time to poverty level. And you know, so it's built into the system to have the inequality that we are seeing right now in our country. And we have to take reasonable steps. I think all of these are reasonable steps to make sure that the wealthy who have benefited from the kinds of investments that we've made in this country in infrastructure and education, and they're not paying their fair share.
I wanted to just ask you one last question about our state in Illinois and our billionaire governor, who has proposed some significant changes to the way that our state income tax structure works. I wonder, as we see that conversation will continue here in Illinois over the next year, what you think about states and states' abilities to change the income tax rate.
Well, we have one of the most unfair tax systems in the country in Illinois. Because we have this flat tax so that middle and lower income people end up paying more as a percentage, far more than the wealthy. And having a fair tax, a graduated income tax, has made sense for a long, long time. Most people, 95% are actually going to benefit from that, and we're going to see the wealthiest Illinois residents pay more, as is the case in most states that have income taxes around the country.
Representative Jan Schakowsky represents Illinois' 9th Congressional District. Representative, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Those conferences in D.C. that Representative Schakowsky attended yesterday might seem far off from our lives here in Illinois, but they're places where people in politics hash out ideas and then bring them to the floor in Congress or in state and local governments. I'm joined now by Thea Lee, president of the Economic Policy Institute. As I mentioned, that's the conference that sparked this whole conversation. Hi, Thea. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thea, I wonder, when you think, do you think that when people see headlines about taxing the wealthy or a wealth tax, Do you think that we often understand exactly who is being targeted here when we're saying a wealth tax?
That's a great question. And I think maybe not. I think that people have a sense of the rich as being maybe just somebody who's a little bit prosperous. But most of the proposals that are on the table now that are being discussed in Congress or by the presidential candidates are actually looking to tax the super wealthy. The wealth tax is for people who have more than $50 million. That's a lot of money. Or a lot of these others are, you know, hitting at $10 million income or $2 million income. So, you know, these are really, not your dentist. These are folks who, in many cases, have inherited wealth, in many cases are earning a lot of income from owning a lot of income.
And so then for those folks, I wonder, oftentimes the objections that we hear to taxing the wealthy are that, for example, some people would say that increasing taxes on both the incomes and the wealth of the very rich could make our country less attractive for business. And certainly we've heard this argument in Illinois, as well as we're talking about our debate that's happening here within our state about changing our tax structure. What's your response to that?
Well, you know, there are always issues, and you need to take into account whether if people are mobile and businesses can be mobile, and certainly taxation is one factor that people take into account. But we also have to think about what businesses and wealthy people get from the taxes they pay. You know, a wealthy country like the United States can't survive without a solid tax base. And there's a question about people paying their fair share. And if, a business uses the roads, they breathe clean air, they hire workers who have, in many cases, gone to public schools. And so, you know, we have a sense of ourselves as a society where we are like an organism. We benefit from each other's work, we benefit from each other's investments, and having a tax code that can generate enough revenue to take care of all the ordinary things that people take for granted that they get from the government is kind of a basic of good governance. So I think we need to think about that frame in that way and not so much be so defensive or apologetic about having a decent tax code.
And I wonder, another argument that we hear oftentimes is that people might move their assets somewhere else, or we might see people moving assets offshore instead of getting taxed. Do you think that's a possibility?
Sure. It is a possibility. I think it gets a little bit exaggerated, and there is research on that shows that, you know, a lot of countries, including the United States, in the not too distant past, had much higher tax rates. And, you know, people, sure, they can move to the Bahamas or they can, you know, move to another country, but there's a lot that they get out of being an American citizen or being an American-based business. You know, in terms of state-to-state issues, it's a lot of trouble also to move. And so I think any business or any individual has to weigh the benefits they get from all the great things that are in Illinois or in the United States of America and all the, you know, the benefits of the universities and the roads and the infrastructure and the skilled workers and so on. So those are all, let's not focus just on the negatives, but let's focus on the pride that we have in being part of a well-functioning society with great infrastructure and great technology and great workers.
I'm speaking with Thea Lee, president of the Economic Policy Institute. We're talking about different proposals for taxing the uber rich, the ultra rich. And as we think about this, we've been talking a lot about Republican viewpoints on this. Where would you say the GOP as a party is right now when it comes to changing tax policy?
Well, we saw where the GOP is because they gave us the TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, last year, and that was pretty much a disgraceful policy that, as I think Representative Schakowsky said, blew a couple of trillion-dollar hole in the budget and did so in the worst possible way by giving money back to wealthy people and corporations.
So having these conversations now, you don't think is anything that will change in this Congress, I assume, then, you're thinking?
Well, I think, you know, certainly there's a lot of energy in this Congress, mostly from the Democrats, to introduce bills that lay out their vision that is in very much a contrast to the Republican tax bill of last year that benefited the super wealthy and corporations who are not paying their fair share. So whether those will get all the way through the Congress, probably not that likely, but this is really laying a foundation. And I think it's also a way of the different parties talking to voters about what it is they would do if they were in power. And so I think this is an important conversation to be having this year so that voters can think about what kind of a public sector we want and what kind of a tax system we want.
And Thea, I wonder, as we think about the Democratic Party, there's obviously, I'm sure there are people who are listening now who are thinking that they don't think that some of the presidential candidates are far enough left on this issue. Do you think there is enough mainstream support in the Democratic Party right now for these policies for taxing the ultra rich?
Well, we'll see, I guess. I do think that there is support. And as at our conference yesterday in Washington with the Institute for Policy Studies and the Economic Policy Institute, Celinda Lake, who's a very skilled pollster, presented a lot of research and the reports and the polls that she's been engaging in, saying there's never been a better time in terms of public perceptions, that maybe 61% of Republicans think we should be taxing the wealthy more than we do.
Mm. All right. Well, we'll see how this plays out. It's interesting to kind of have a context to the debates that will happen this evening, the debates that will be happening here in Illinois over the next year. Thea Lee is president of the Economic Policy Institute based in Washington. We'll tweet out some more information about this conference, including an interesting piece Paul Krugman wrote about in The New York Times, a little bit more about his philosophies on this. Thea, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after the break, how Illinois is violating a court order that's supposed to provide for non-native English families in the foster care system. We know about this because of some journalism by ProPublica Illinois. They're going to be joining us just after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Many parents remember their child's first words, but imagine if those words were in a language that was completely foreign to you. Jorge Matias is a native Spanish speaker. He learned English living and working in Chicago. A few years ago, his youngest son was put into the foster care system in Illinois shortly after his birth because he was born with heroin in his system. But when Jorge visited the foster family shortly before his son turned one, the first words he heard from his child were in Slovak, a language Jorge was completely unfamiliar with. Illinois is actually obligated by consent decree to place foster children with families that speak languages that their biological parents can understand. But a recent ProPublica Illinois investigation found that this rule isn't always followed, especially when it comes to Spanish-speaking families. Dua Eldeeb is a reporter with ProPublica Illinois who co-wrote the story with Melissa Sanchez, and she's joining us now from Chicago. Hi, Dua. Welcome back to The 21st. Dua, it looks like we're...
Yes.
Hi, Dua. Thanks for being with
Hi,
us.
Nyla.
Thanks.
Yes, thanks for having me. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Lila Suleiman Gonzalez is also with us from Chicago. She's the director of the Human Services Program at Loyola University Chicago. She also worked as a monitor to ensure that the Department of Children and Family Services followed this consent decree. Hi, Lila. Thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us today.
And also, I want to welcome Jorge Matias, who joins us from Guatemala. Jorge, thank you for being here with us on the program.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so Jorge, I wonder if you could start by telling us about your children, in particular your first son.
Well, what do you want to tell him? I mean, he's a happy child and he likes to play.
Yeah, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what it was like when you first visited him in foster care, when he first started speaking. How was it to communicate with him?
It was really hard because his first words were in Slovak, and since then, his primary language has been Slovak.
And that's because the foster family that he's with, that's their primary language?
Yes, that's what they speak at home, and that's what they speak to him, even though they speak English.
Okay, so he doesn't. So he doesn't speak English then very well. Your son.
Since he's going to school, but before, but still, he prefers to speak in Slovak when that's his preferred language.
And Jorge, when your son was put into the foster care system, were you aware that there was this consent decree that you had the ability to, first of all, I don't know if you, if you talk to people about the need to have your child in an English or Spanish speaking home, did you even know that existed?
Not really. And when it was brought up to me, it was really kind of late and I didn't want to move him because I thought I was going to have him back soon. So I didn't, and my head, it was not, for me, it was not right to move him again. Because it would hurt him, but I thought it was going to be a really short time that he was going to be there, so I didn't want to move him from one family to another family. I didn't want the trauma on him.
Yeah, that makes us certainly understandable. Dua, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about DCFS, what the process happens, why Jorge's son was put with a foster family, and how the process should have happened?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, DCFS is under this federal court consent decree, which requires them to place children of Spanish-speaking families in foster homes where Spanish is spoken. There is a way that there's something called like a language termination form, which is effectively a waiver. And what we found is that families are, some Spanish-speaking families we heard from and workers at different agencies have said that families are being told that, you know, they can get their services faster, they can get their children quicker if they choose English instead of Spanish as required in the consent decree. And so, for example, in, you know, Jorge's case, you know, at the very beginning there was the child was placed with these foster families before there was even a DNA test done to confirm that, you know, Jorge was the father. But even after that happened, the agency said that they kept the child in that home. At the beginning, they thought that this process was going to take, you know, several months. And now at this point, it's been several years.
So, Jorge, you thought originally, I imagine as well, that you would have your son back with you pretty quickly, that this wouldn't be a long situation?
Yes, that's what I thought. But I don't know why, but it has taken this long for him. He's still in the system.
Lila, can you explain a little bit to us about this consent decree that Dua was telling us about? It's called the Burgos Consent Decree.
That's right. So the Burgos Consent Decree is named after the family that filed the class action lawsuit, the Burgos family. And, they suffered a similar experience with DCFS where their children were taken into custody and placed in foster home where they didn't speak Spanish. Again, it was expected to be a short-term placement, but it ended up being years and years. In the meantime, the children lost their language. And then, you know, we have to remember that language is connected to identity, to culture, to family. So once the children lost their language, they weren't able to communicate with the family anymore. They also lost their identity. Their names were changed to English-sounding names. They lost the culture. They lost cultural practices. They lost a whole lot. So when it came time to place or reunite the family after many years of being out, it was a shock to the system to have the children come back into a family they were no longer connected to because, again, they had lost the language. They couldn't communicate with their family members, with their parents, and they also were not connected to the culture any longer. So we can talk about language, but it's important to connect language to culture and identity. Mm-hmm. Now, the Burgos Consent Decree is a class action lawsuit filed in 1975 on behalf of all Latino families, so all Hispanic or Latino families are part of this class action lawsuit. And it requires that there be a language determination form where the family is the one that makes a choice about how they, what language they want services in, English or Spanish. And then There was a consent decree as a result of that class action lawsuit that was filed in 1977, and there were subsequent agreed orders because DCFS was non-compliant. And basically, the consent decree says it's based on Title VI of the Civil Rights Law. So this is civil rights. It's an issue of discrimination. It's not just an issue of language.
And as you're saying, and identity as well. Yeah, Lila, thank you for that. We're speaking with Lila Suleiman-Gonzalez, the Director of Human Services Program at Loyola University in Chicago. At one point, she was a monitor to ensure that DCFS was following this consent decree that we've been talking about. So, Dua, is this just for Spanish-speaking children, or does this happen with other languages as well?
So this consent decree is specific to Spanish. DCFS had says, you know, more broadly that they care about ensuring that children of all cultures and languages and backgrounds have adequate services, but this consent decree is specific to Spanish.
And does, I know with ProPublica Illinois, the reporting that you and Melissa did with this, do you guys have a sense of how many other families are facing situations like Jorge's and are and maybe in similar situations?
So what we found, and, you know, it's important to preface this with the fact that DCFS has very bad data and that the data, not just on, you know, race and language and, you know, possible Burgos violations is, you know, poor now. It's been that way for decades. But with that, we found that there have been about 300 possible Burgos violations since 2005.
300?
Mm-hmm.
In Illinois?
In Illinois, yes.
Okay.
Statewide.
Okay. And I guess that this might be, I'm not sure, Lila, if you want to answer this, and then Dua, if you could chime in. If this is something that happened that was implemented back in the 70s, how is it possible that this consent decree is still not being followed? If we're talking about something that's been part of the language for more than 40 years.
I think that part of the reason why it's not being followed is just it's a lack of priority. We've been hearing in the news about the lack of resources that have been allocated budget-wise to DCFS, and so they have other priorities, and this keeps falling further and further down on the list of, you know, where to invest and where to put resources. So I think that's been a key issue. Latino kids have only been about 6 to 8% of the population of out-of-home care. And so because of that number, DCFS has continuously kind of set it aside. Plus, as you know, DCFS has been in crisis mode. It has had over 8 directors
in Illinois.
Many years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In Illinois, correct.
So
we just fall through the cracks.
Dua, as we're thinking about that, as Lila saying the idea of falling through the cracks, what did DCFS say to you about the reporting that ProPublica did?
So, you know, they said that with the new director who was just appointed by Governor Pritzker, they said that, you know, he is going to now make this a priority, that they are looking kind of top to bottom at how they are using data, how they are tracking compliance, and that they, you know, want to make sure to address these problems. That's just in the most general terms. We haven't been able to nail down specifics with them, but that is something that we're going to continue reporting on.
Jorge, I want to go back to your story. If you don't mind sharing with us a little bit more, I wonder, you were talking about how difficult it was to communicate with your son when you saw him. Were you also worried that the language barrier would also make it more difficult to regain custody of your son?
Well, it became apparent as we went on, because bonding with my kid, it became hard. Even talking to him, even taking to the park, sometimes it became a really difficult thing to do because of the language barrier and how we couldn't communicate or bond.
Mm-hmm. And Dua, what recourse do parents like Jorge have in a situation like this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a question of, you know, do they know what their rights are and are they able to demand them? So in Jorge's situation, you know, he had a public defender who wrote a letter to the DCFS Inspector General, and that's what really elevated his case. And so then the Inspector General issued an investigation, started investigation and issued a report where she found a pattern of bias in decision-making in the private agency that was contracted by DCFS to handle Jorge's case. And it was, you know, after that, just recently, that DCFS agreed to the recommendations of the Inspector General's report.
Lila, I wonder how this is supposed to happen. As the consent decree is entered, what the process is supposed to be like and what recourse families are supposed to have?
Well, families have several different recourses depending on their background. So, for example, if you're a Mexican national, there is an agreement, a memorandum of agreement that was signed with the Consulate of Mexico because of the issues that we were having with Mexican families. So under Mexican law, children, even if they're born in the United States, are still Mexican nationals. And due to some other international law treaties, once another country like United States or the state of Illinois takes custody, then they are bound to report it to the consulate. So for Mexican families, that agreement is in place. Also, families can complain to the Inspector General, as was done in this case by the public defender, to initiate an investigation. And then there's another level of the Office of Civil Rights under the Department of Health and Human Services, and they can also file a complaint there, which would then be investigated. Again, this is a violation of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, and which says that you cannot deny, delay, or provide a different type of service just because someone is limited English speaking.
So, Lila, in Jorge's case, if Jorge's Guatemalan, I wonder if there are other, if that has any impact on, you were talking about Mexican families and maybe there's some other laws when it comes to that. What about if you're Guatemalan?
Well, if you're Guatemalan, I'm not sure about the Constitution in Guatemala, and if it says that a child born outside of the country to a Guatemalan national is still Guatemalan. So that would deal directly with the case of taking custody of a child. And that's under the Vienna Treaty of the International United Nations. So for example, if someone that is a U.S. citizen is taken abroad by another country, that country has to notify the consulate of the United States immediately. So the same would happen here. Now, even if the child is not considered a Guatemalan national, Jorge, as a Guatemalan father, does have rights. And the Guatemalan consulate should be able to also assist him in getting his rights as a father, regarded and honored, even if it's in an outside court.
Thanks for
the issue of bias. Mm-hmm. Well, we see a lot of bias in the system.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a question I wanted to ask you about. But before we get to that, Jorge, can I just ask you, what is your hope for your son? What do you want to have happen here?
Well, I really want him to come and live with me anywhere I am. I also want him to grow up happy and I'm a good citizen, so I wish I could raise him. That's been why I'm trying to get him back for all this time.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And thank you for sharing your story with us, Jorge. Dua, what's next when we think about Jorge and his family in this specific case?
Well, in terms of, you know, this specific case, there's a Cook County juvenile judge is expected to rule on where the permanent placement will be. So, you know, in addition to, you know, his oldest son, there have been two more children that have entered the picture. And so, you know, Jorge has a daughter who's also placed with the same foster family, and then another daughter that's placed with Jorge's relatives. And so there's a question of permanency at this point. Where will they end up living? And I think one of the things that the Inspector General's report really highlighted was just what a difficult situation this is. And, you know, what led up to this is really problematic. But now that we're at this point, you know, what's
the best thing for the children.
Yeah, it's a difficult situation, obviously. And Jorge, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate you doing that. Jorge Matias, Dua Eldeeb brought us a story with ProPublica Illinois. We'll tweet out Dua and Melissa's reporting. And I want to thank Laila Suleiman Gonzalez for being with us as well from Loyola University Chicago. All of you, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Between texts, emails, or social media, it's hard to put down your phone. Maybe you're looking at it right now. And there are certain places, though, where we know we shouldn't be on our screens, like in bed or at the dinner table. And one place you shouldn't ever, ever be on your phone is in your car while you are driving. Despite that, last year, Illinois State Police issued more than 15,000 citations for distracted driving. Starting Monday, Illinois drivers caught using their phones will face harsher penalties, including fines and the possibility of getting their licenses suspended. Sergeant Dave Nicosia is the traffic unit sergeant for the Rockford Police Department. He's on the line with us now. Sergeant Nicosia, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much.
I wonder if you can tell us how pervasive a problem distracted driving is. How much are you seeing this out on the roads?
It's a huge problem, and just kind of, you alluded to it in your intro, everybody has a phone. I mean, it's not just younger people or older people. Everybody has cell phones, so we're seeing it across the board.
And what are the results of this? Are you seeing accidents happen because people are not paying attention?
Sure. It looking at your phone just takes your attention away from the road, and sometimes it only takes 1 second for something to occur to where a crash occurs. So, yeah, we have seen an increase in crashes due to cell phone use.
And is this because people are texting specifically, or are they doing other things on their phone, Sergeant?
You know, I think it's just using the phone in general, and it depends on the person's, how much they use a phone, or, you know, are they trying to read emails? Phones are just basically computers now, the smartphones. So it's not just a matter of, hey, you had to make a call, or, you know, people are doing all kinds of things with the phones.
And before these news laws took effect, what was the penalty for using your phone while driving? What recourse did you have when you were pulling folks over?
So the big change is the first offense that'll change tomorrow is a non-moving violation. So it did not go against your driver's license. So as of July 1st, if you're pulled over and issued a citation, that'll be considered a moving violation in the state of Illinois. And it goes against your license, and three moving violations within a year. Doesn't have to be for the same violation, just three movers in a 12-month period could suspend your license.
And a moving violation, I imagine, also is a ding against your insurance as well, right? So that's something that people will also be paying attention to?
Correct. And that's a good point. So when you change insurance, your insurance runs a check on your driver's license, which they do periodically to determine your rates. If you have moving violations, they, you know, consider you a higher risk of a person to get in an accident. And of course, that'll affect your rates to make them go up.
So, Sergeant Nicosia, in what cases would you then be issuing citations for this? Is it just about texting? Can it be applied to any kind of phone use?
So, basically, the law is simple. Anytime, it's a handheld law. Anytime something's in your hand while you're driving, you're in violation of the law. So, in other words, if you use your phone for, say, GPS purposes, as long as you plan the route on your phone prior to leaving a parked position, you're fine. You can use the GPS as long as it's not in your hands. Same as making a call. If you make a call, maybe voice activated, call so-and-so, and the call goes through, that's fine. So it's all about the device in your hands.
And what if you're at a red light? Does that count as a stop?
So, good question. If you're at a red light, that does count as a violation if you start using your phone. The law, one of the exceptions is if you're parked on the shoulder of the, if you're parked on the shoulder of the road and the car is in park, that would be okay. Or another exception is if you're, say you're stopped for a bad crash and traffic is just, it's obstructed, not a stoplight, but it's actually obstructed and you're stopped. As long as the vehicle is in park or neutral at the time, you would be allowed to use your phone that time. That's one of the exceptions.
Sergeant, are you hoping that this will help curb some of the problems that we're seeing with distracted driving? The fact that people, this will now be a moving violation, are you hoping this will help solve the problem?
I am, because our main goal is compliance. And, you know, I go to all these serious crashes in our city. And, you know, we all have family on the road, and we just want to keep everybody safe.
Yeah, and it's a good reminder while we're at it for everyone to remember, for folks that are pulled over on the road, that they should move over as well when you are pulling people over. That's Sergeant Dave Nicosia, Traffic Unit Sergeant with the Rockford Police Department. Thank you for speaking with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Rapino will strike. Rapino scores to NUS.
That's Fox Sports with the exciting conclusion to Monday's World Cup match between the U.S. and Spain. A pair of penalty shots from Megan Rapinoe ensured the team would move on to Friday's quarterfinal versus France. Unlike their male counterparts, our U.S. women are top-ranked when it comes to world soccer. For more on the team and what we can expect later this week, we're joined by Annie Costable. She's with the Chicago Sun-Times, and she also hosts a Chicago sports podcast, Catching Up with Costable and Kenny. Annie, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate this phone call.
So it was a pretty close game Monday against Spain. Were you on edge? It ended up being a closer game than people thought it would be, right?
Well, when Rapinoe scored on the first PK, I was at ease. And then quickly Spain matched the score, and it was tied 1-1. And as the time ticked down, my anxieties rose higher and higher. But when the second penalty kick came up and Rapinoe stepped up, I knew right then that they were going to take care of it. But, you know, when you're watching Team USA, you always have the faith, but I think it definitely got a little nerve-wracking there.
I wonder if we can talk about some of the big stars of this team. Rapinoe is definitely one of them. Alex Morgan is another. What kind of performances have we seen for them so far in this tournament?
I mean, I think that standout performances have come from our younger players, one specifically Tierna Davidson, who is a member of the Chicago Red Stars. You can watch her right here in Chicago or in Illinois. And just going off of that, we have four members from the Red Stars playing for the U.S. Women's National Team. But Davidson, I believe it was against in the second game in group play, she had, I think, three assists. And like I said, this team has a lot of veteran talent, like Rapinoe, like Alex Morgan, like you mentioned. But they have a lot of young stars as well. Mallory Pugh's another one. So I think that it's been a joy to watch some of these young players step up to the challenge and really show what the future of the U.S. Women's National Team is going to be and is now.
And so I wonder if you could mention for us Illinois fans, the other Red Stars players. So that's the women's professional team that's based here in Chicago, as you mentioned. So you can actually get a chance to see these women. Who else have you noticed, or who else, whether their names should we be keeping an eye out for, Annie?
Yeah, definitely. Julie Ertz, our goalkeeper, Alyssa Nair, who's just an absolute beast out there. She's incredible. She's also a member of the Red Stars. And then Morgan Bryan is the final member of the Red Stars that's playing for the U.S. Women's National Team. Casey Short is another superstar talent that you'll definitely see on that elite stage again. She also plays for our Red Stars. She's not with the U.S. Women's National Team right now. Her name was left off that final roster list. It surprised a lot of people, but she'll definitely get an opportunity to make up for that, whether it's in the Olympics or in a World Cup to come 4 years from now. You'll definitely see Casey Short's name back in the mix.
I wonder, Annie, what other teams you're excited about. I think always the fun of the World Cup is that there are different countries that maybe people didn't expect to do well that have emerged as sort of fan favorites. What other teams have you been paying attention to?
I was definitely excited to see the matchup against Spain, especially because our women's team kind of soared through group play pretty easily. So playing against Spain was definitely an important match in setting up their match against France, just because the level of talent was going to be tougher than what they saw in group play. I obviously think the game against France is what everyone has been waiting for. I think it's what everyone's been anxiously awaiting. And, you know, it's early on here in the World Cup, but, you know, it's definitely going to be an intense battle between two really, really talented teams. And you can guarantee that France is going to give USA everything they have.
And obviously the tournament is in France. I wonder how much that helps the French team, the French side. It is kind of a home game for them.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that's the pretty cool thing about USA and the fan base that the women's national team has. Players have commented throughout the World Cup of just the number of fans that have come out. So I think that Rapinoe in her post-game interview was commenting about it being a split stadium and USA having that fan base there too. I think obviously it being in France is going to be positive for France's US or France's women's national team, but our fans definitely travel and it'll be, I think, pretty evenly matched in the stadium.
Annie, I wonder if also, I mean, when we're thinking about the U.S. women playing the French women in this quarterfinal game, this is almost like a final game because they really are
right.
The two best teams, right?
Right. I mean, definitely. That's what everyone was kind of hyping this up as and almost disappointed that it was coming in the quarterfinals, such a, you know, intense matchup like this. But I think that it's going to be fun either way. You know, people have said this has the final, you know, aura around it. Unfortunately, it's coming in the quarterfinals, but I think it'll be just as exciting as if it was the finals. And whatever the outcome is, then put hopefully Team USA on the track to the finals, and they have their biggest test behind them.
We're speaking with Annie Costable about the Women's World Cup. And Annie, you mentioned the crowds. I wonder if we're seeing a level of excitement around the Women's World Cup this time around. If you see that the fan excitement, the energy around it, of course, it's really difficult to compare anything to the Men's World Cup because it really is pretty much kind of the biggest sporting event in the world. But are we seeing levels of excitement grow over women's soccer?
Absolutely. I mean, I think when it comes to the comparison of our men's national team versus our women's national team, our women's national team has a bigger following. They've been better consistently for years. And I think we're seeing that grow. I think one thing that needs to be taken advantage of when you're talking about the hype and the support and the excitement surrounding women's soccer is how to carry it from supporting our women's national team to supporting the NWSL. So the NWSL is in its seventh year, and 58 of our NWSL players are playing in the World Cup, whether it be for the U.S. team or different teams that are competing in the World Cup. For example, Sam Kerr, another player for the Red Stars, is playing for the Australian national team. So it's interesting that our national team gets so much excitement and so much support, but then these women come back and are playing right here in the United States, and fans almost forget about them. So when we talk about growing women's soccer and the interest in it and the hype around it, I think it's important for fans to know that the level of athleticism you're seeing when these women are competing for the World Cup is right here in our backyard throughout the United States, and you can see them anytime.
So, Annie, you were mentioning Julie Ertz. Actually, a couple weeks ago, there was a controversy over a CBS News article that failed to mention her by name, and it said it focused on her husband going to support her. I know you were kind of calling CBS out on Twitter about this.
Yeah, and I mean, it's calling people out on Twitter, at least coming from me, is never from a malicious, judgmental, evil standpoint. I think the beauty of Twitter is that when you call people out, you're just raising expectations and maybe enlightening people on something that they weren't aware of before. So when I read that headline, it just stood out so much because when you're looking at Julie's career and Zach's, they've supported each other so beautifully from, you know, throughout everything. But when you're comparing, facts are facts, and Julie Ertz is a World Cup champion and Zach's won a Super Bowl. So if you're comparing that in itself, like Julie is arguably more recognizable, and yet she was lessened to just the status of a wife. And it was interesting because on Twitter, you're allotted, you know, a certain amount of characters, and they easily could have put her name and her title and her accomplishments. So to me, it was interesting that this superstar woman gets characterized as just wife, which I'm sure she was proud to wear that title. Her and Zach's relationship, they have a beautiful relationship. So I don't even think it was about not wanting to be called his wife. I think it was just more about the fact that women deserve more respect, not even just Julie, but women in general. And it's about creating the conversation that you may not have seen the problem with this, but this was an issue, a bigger issue, and that women just deserve more respect than that.
That's Annie Costable. She's a multimedia journalist with the Chicago Sun-Times. She's also host of Catching Up with Costable and Kenny podcast, a Chicago sports podcast that spotlights female athletes, if you want to check that out. Annie, thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm happy to be here.
That's all the time we have for today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Anna Casey, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Eunice Alpasan and Jasper Davidoff are our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.